Access number 30408, Major Bob Godfrey, Reel 7. Now, what about the food? What would you eat? I mean, you weren't going out on a five, you know, when you're going out for 4 or 5 days, what would you take with you, and would you heat it up? I'm thinking of smoke and things like that. Food
you,
and cooking.
Yeah, you took the compo ration from 10-man ration packs, normally, which comprised tins, round normal tins, as the shape that we see today, you know. They would be tins of stew, steak, tins of very salty bacon, tins of sausages, tins of sort of bully beef. Sometimes you've got to having tins of hamburgers, and then you had tins of rich fruit cake. It was ridiculous sounding thing, you know. Tins of sponge pudding. You had bars of chocolate. And most important of all, you had little compo, little burners, little sort of tablets, a fuel with a small collapsible metal frame. You lit the fuel tablet.
Tommy cooker,
thank you. Yep. And you had your mess tins and you cooked the food.
And each of you cooked your own, did they? Or did
Well, it depends. If I was needed to be, if I was on the radio or something with the signaller, then one of the bloke I was sleeping, sharing the basher with, would cook my food for me. Usually we just took it in turns together and cooked according to what, you know, one would cook the stew and the other would cook. I can't remember what we had in the way. I think we had. We did have tinned potatoes, I think. What, for the most part, by the time one had been in the jungle for a few weeks or months, and you would say you would be taking rice, and you would be taking curry powder, and you would be taking tins of stewing steak, and you would be taking bars of chocolate, as many as you could get hold of. And that probably would be your staple diet, almost, and lots of tea. And lots of sugar, and lots of milk.
So moving away from the compo food rations, or just to certain elements within.
Yeah, that's right. Designing it to suit yourselves, really. Yeah, that's right. The greatest thing ever in the world was toothpaste tubes of sweetened condensed milk. Because how otherwise can you, operating in jungle conditions, keep your milk? You can't open a great tin of condensed milk, you know, and then take it on your back wrapped. You could never have kept it. But tubes you could. You just screw the lid back on and threw it into your pack.
Now, what about the creepy crawlies of jungle life? I mean, I mean snakes, insects, nasty things.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, did they bother you, or were there many about it? Often they seem to get the other way.
Yeah, there were.
Did it bother you?
It didn't worry me. I was very unhappy about snakes because I knew I couldn't identify the dangerous ones from the safe ones. We saw plenty of snakes in our daily lives. I mean, you would have seen, I think you almost certainly see one snake a day if one was trying to sort of put an average to it. If I saw a snake that looked as though it was going to be close to our party in single file, I had no hesitation in chopping it. If you sat on a dead tree, you very carefully, before you sat on it, you cleared the bark off, because underneath the bark you'd almost certainly find a scorpion. And that's the sum total of any anxiety I had. I just was cautious about snakes, because what I didn't want was somebody to be seriously hurt by a snake poison. And I didn't want anybody to sit on a scorpion sting. That was it. Nothing else. Really.
They don't sound like they were much of a problem. More of a possible nuisance rather than.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct.
But you weren't worried about leeches and things like that.
Leeches. There were plenty of them. There were hundreds of leeches. But you learnt to get rid of them. The way you got rid of them, best of all, because everybody smoked in those days, was to burn them off. You know, if they caught on your fingers, I've still got scars between my fingers where they were, you just put a cigarette end on them and they drop off. If you try and pull them off, the head is left in and it will go septic. The other way is to rub soap on them, and they didn't like that, or salt. Plenty of leeches, and of course if you were in low-lying country, you would see them standing waiting for you. They hope they usually would get onto a pig or something, and if they got a human being, they'd be delighted. You see them sort of standing up on the edge of leaf waiting to get onto you as you went past.
So it wasn't just in water you picked them up?
No. And everything is wet in the jungle, so they live very comfortably throughout the jungle. The water leeches are much bigger. I mean, they could be anything up to 4 inches or so. But the normal leech, which was what we met, would be very thin to start with, at about 1 inch long, and finish up like a great slug full of your blood. It would be quite common to take your boot and sock off at night and find you've got about 8 or 10 leeches on your foot.
They get through
They sort of find their way through. I mean, jungle boots were strapped up to a sort of calf. They would go underneath the jungle boot, in through the sock, down part. However much you tried to keep them out, they would get there. Very adept. And you weren't spending your life on patrol worrying about whether you were getting leeches, you know. You just got on with it, really, as a hazard that you accepted.
Any other nuisances of jungle life?
Not really, no. I mean, the only difficulty was if somebody was seriously ill or hurt. That rarely happened. Or, of course, if one had casualties or people killed in action.
Now, so when you went on a reconnaissance patrol, was it your sole purpose to locate a camp, or was it to attack it as well? Because there's not many of you, are there? There's, what, 15, 12, 15? Mm-hmm. And, I mean, as your sergeant found,
yes,
if you bump 100, it could be nasty for
you. Yeah.
So what was the plan, overall idea?
The plan overall was to go into the jungle, locate the enemy, and attack him.
So would attack?
You would attack, absolutely, you would attack. It was very interesting. Over our period there, from 48 to 53, the terrorists started with huge camps and very rapidly reduced their camps to much smaller sizes. The army started patrolling at company strength and then dropped to platoon strength and then dropped to section strength, because everybody recognised, and I think both sides recognised, that in jungle, such as it was, where you could only see, you know, only see as far as the back end of our kitchen sitting here, you know, you couldn't see beyond that.
8 meters, 9 feet.
Yeah, at the most, yeah. It didn't make any difference whether you had 100 men behind you, probably, or only 15. And the enemy wouldn't know how many you had, and they didn't stop. I mean, that occasion when Ashdown was killed was a desperately sad fluke, quite honestly. I mean, the bandit camp just disintegrated. They fled. They were not there when I got back to rescue the body. I've lost my train. So
no, we're just talking about the size of the camps and what you did with them. You know, I mean,
oh, yeah.
No,
right. So we operated comfortably as a section of 15 men. We were not afraid to attack an enemy camp. And certainly we were less afraid once the camps had become much smaller.
So in the first couple of reconnaissance patrols, would you find... So you'd go out for, 4 or 5 days?
Yeah.
And would you find anything? Oh, do you remember on those first... I don't know how you want to deal with the next bit, whether you remember individual patrols and contact incidents, or whether you remember, you know, generally things.
Yeah. I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, I commenced my patrolling, I suppose, in August 1950, and I patrolled through until December 1952. During that time, I had 2 weeks leave when I went with Adrian Gilmore over to the East Coast to a beach resort. But 2 weeks leave in whatever number of years that was, nearly 3 years.
So it's constant patrol.
We patrolled on a routine of a fortnight work and then 2 days recreation. Fortnight's work, 2 days, or 12 days work, 2 days recreation.
So would that be two patrols in essence?
It would be, it could comprise 2 4-day patrols, it could comprise a 5-day patrol. We reckon we could go without air supply for up to 5 days. It might include a 5-day patrol, a couple of day patrols, and a night ambush in that period of 12 days.
Now, how would you set up a night ambush? What was the technique?
Well, you knew that there were tracks which before the Briggs plan came into operation, we needn't talk about that particularly, but the Briggs plan was designed to deny to the enemy in the jungle the ability to gain support from villagers. The population in Malaya was 2/5 Chinese, 2/5 Malay, and 1/5 Indian, by and large. It was the Chinese, by and large, only who supported the bandits, the communist terrorists. It was a small proportion of the Chinese who supported them, and it was those Chinese that lived on the fringes of society, squatting in areas which they cleared themselves from the edges of the jungle and set up small communities. It was from those communities that the enemy got their sustenance, either by force or by willing cooperation. And the Briggs plan removed all those squatters.
Sketch out the Briggs plan as you knew it then, not as a historian.
Because, no.
I mean, what did you know it existed at the time?
Oh yes, we knew it. After Sir Henry Gurney was ambushed and killed, and Templar came to take over from him as boss, he brought with him General Briggs, who he'd known for many years before, and he brought with him with the aim of he should become director of operations, and Briggs, estimated, I mean, this is what I understood at the time, and it was exactly accurate, he said that we've got to deny the communists the ability to gain support from outside the jungle, and the people who are supporting them, whether they want to or not, are the squatters. And of course the new villages were created under the Briggs plan. The squatters were shifted bodily out of their jungle edge squatter areas into these new villages. Most of them were delighted to be protected and away from intimidation, though of course there were some communist supporters among them, not many. This automatically denied the terrorists their access to food, to vegetables, rice, etc., and incidentally drove them deeper into the jungle to create their own farms inside the jungle areas, which made our job rather more difficult, led to things like the SAS coming out to live long term in the heart of the jungle.
So that was the other thing. Now, ambush plan. So how would you set up an ambush?
You would set up an ambush because there was a track leading out of the, a logging track, let's say, for example, coming out of the jungle, through some secondary jungle, through some baluka, which is scrub, which has been cleared originally from jungle, into a squatter area, which would comprise sort of a dozen, 15 huts where dozen or 15 families lived. And if they were careless, and they often were, the terrorists would come on in this track by night. So what you had to do was to locate, find a place on that track between the edge of the jungle and the squatter camp, which was a suitable place for setting up an ambush. You would have your 15-man section. You would locate them along the edge of the track, not too far back, but within sort of to be fairly well hidden, And the difficulty was getting there in the first place without the locals creating, becoming aware of it and therefore creating lots of noise or whatever. If they started banging their pots and pans and so on, you knew that you'd blown it. If everything was quiet as dusk fell, then you had a high hope that the enemy might choose this night to go out of the jungle into this camp area, into this squatter area. And you would line up, and you would have a Bren gun at each end, and you would have the commander in the centre of the ambush, and you would have, probably you would tie strings one from another down the line of the ambush, because you had to have some way of signalling whether there was an enemy coming, or maybe you were close enough to tap each other on the shoulder and say, enemy coming.
Now, for obvious reasons, just on one side of the track.
So on one side of the track, absolutely, yes. Yeah, certainly, yeah. Yeah.
Just lie there, then?
And then you sit. No, you never lie. You sit there, and you wait. And you're eaten by mosquitoes, and you wait, and you wait. And then if nothing has happened by 10 or 11 o'clock, you give the signal for half of each of the three groups to try and sleep. And then you're quite right, they would lie down for a moment. Yeah.
Why wouldn't they lie? Just explain to them. I mean,
well, you,
there's always
you,
a picture of people lying.
Yes, there was no question of lying down far enough from the track to be able to fire down onto it or across it. You had to be very close to the crack. It was very, otherwise you wouldn't see your enemy. I mean, you might have some form of illumination, Veery lights or something to illuminate, but these things happened in such a rush, and you've probably only got two or three enemy there, and so it would be one hell of a blast off of fire. Hopefully you had alerted everybody, and you would all fire from the sitting position.
It was all about initial impact then?
Oh, yeah, yes, absolutely, I mean, you asked me earlier whether I would be interested in describing a particular patrol that I took.
Absolutely, yes. If you want to look at an individual patrol,
yeah, I could look at one.
So many that
that's right, but some of them stood out very sharply.
Well, let's do a couple of them then. No,
but this is not this is no heroic adventure, but it describes the sort of problems that a platoon commander would have in jungle warfare of the type we were experiencing in Malaya.
Now, do you know when this patrol was?
I don't, but I know it was before the summer of 1952. It was probably back end of 51, beginning of 52. I can't honestly remember. I might be able to find it in there.
What's the background to this?
The background to this is normal patrolling activity, looking for the enemy and not sure where he is. Tending to go deeper into the jungle now, because this was after the Briggs plan and after the squatters had been removed, and therefore after they had started preparing areas in the jungle for cultivation of food for themselves. And I was required to go with my platoon of two sections to go into the jungle to establish a base camp and to patrol from that base camp, leaving just the signaller and a couple of blokes guarding the camp during the day and patrolling with two patrols, looking for the enemy. And we advanced in and we made good progress on the day we entered the jungle. And I was already looking for... I was already looking for a suitable place to set up our camp from which we would do our patrolling on the following day. When my leading scout said, I was at the head, you see, with the leading scout in front, he said, "Sir, I think the jungle is clearing a bit ahead of us." So I said, "Okay, you and I will go and have a look." So I stopped everybody else, and I went forward with him fairly cautiously, and he was absolutely right. The ground ahead was clearing. What they did often in the creation of their jungle allotments, their jungle vegetable gardens, food sources, they would use, because they had to get light, and you can't chop down a whole jungle area with trees with the sort of span that there are. So what they often did, well, there'd been lots of RAF bombing during the campaign. It was never very effective, but it was used as a morale deterrent, really. Sure enough, I said, oh, this is just where there's been a stick of bombs has fallen here, and it's knocked the trees down, and therefore it made it appear that it was lightning, and indeed it was. But as we got closer, lo and behold, it was quite obvious that all the undergrowth around these fallen trees had been cleared. And as we walked into it, it became quite, I was moving with great caution and stealth into it. It was apparent that part of it had already been sown with crops, and that therefore we had, by pure chance, located a jungle garden where they were about to grow food for themselves. I advanced very gingerly into the top corner of this area. It was a slightly flat area, falling away to a stream beyond it from the direction in which I arrived. And was, I, roughly speaking, rectangular in shape, this cleared area. I suppose it was 50 yards long by maybe 30 yards deep, rising up the hill 30 yards, 50 yards along the stream. As I got close to the middle of it, and this is the most extraordinary thing, and this certainly didn't happen very often, I was aware that there were footmarks in the ground joining together to form a path out of the far end of the clearing. And in one of those footmarks, you remember how it's raining every day, all day in the jungle, frequently, into one of those footmarks, water was trickling, which told me one thing, that I'd better creep quietly out of the way, because somebody had made that footmark within, if not minutes, within half an hour before my arrival on the scene. So I withdrew quietly. As far as I could tell, nobody knew that I'd been there with my scout, back to the platoon. And I thought for a minute, and I said, now, what we've got is a party of men working on this clearing, and they have withdrawn for the night, and they're going to come back tomorrow morning. And I'm going to ambush this clearing. And I'm going to put the second section along the right-hand edge of the clearing as a cover group, and I'm going to take my own section and distribute it along the top side of the clearing to be the ambush group. We agreed that, and we ate cold food that night. We made no noise whatsoever. And in the morning, I briefed, well before light, I think it was Sergeant Reese already in those days, I briefed Sergeant Reese where to put his men along the right-hand end of the clearing, and I took my own men, and I deposited them off one group, and then the second group, and then the third group. So you can understand, we were going to fire across the clearing in both cases. I'd got to the recce group, my last group, when I realised that I had overshot the clearing. And I was looking down into jungle, and in fact, I was looking down at a hut. And I was looking at three men. I remember it so distinctly, two of them cleaning weapons and one cleaning his teeth. And so I thought, well, these are the only men working on this clearing. So I said to my recce group, I said, they had already seen it, obviously, as well. I said, look, the whole thing bust. When I stand up, you stand up. And when I fire, you fire. And we stood up and we fired and we killed all three men. And so, that was a classic, typical platoon action in the Malayan emergency, by a chance action against the enemy.
Were you able to, I mean, would you bring the bodies in for identification?
Oh, they were all three brought out, yeah. Straight away, yeah.
And how would they identify? Do you know any, what sort of intelligence could you get from them?
Well, one of the first things that the police did, and it was, the emphasis became even stronger after Templer and Briggs arrived, developed the special branch, which was developed from nothing, really. And by the sort of middle of 51, I suppose, they had a very good idea from whichever source, and every police station had a set of wanted men photographs in it of the major terrorists within the area. And there were numbers of surrendered enemy personnel, SEPs we called them, surrendered enemy personnel, who surrendered for the bounties that were offered for surrender, and were able to identify their former comrades frequently. And so I don't know whether those three were identified, but certainly I would think on average one of them would have been, if not all.
And what about the liaison with the police? Was that carried on at the level of headquarters or company? I know you said the colonel spent the longest time doing it.
Well, we were in... I arrived when we were in Sagama. Soon after I arrived, we moved up to Selangor, the state in which Kuala Lumpur sits, the capital of Malaya, and the capital of Malaysia now, sits in the centre of the state of Selangor, Selangor. Selangor police were divided into three sections called circles. There was the chief of police for the state in KL, Kuala Lumpur. And then the southern circle, which was the area where we were operating from, was based on the town of Kajang, K-A-J-A-N-G. And the South Selangor police circle had a commander who was the man that was with Colonel Philip Morecambe. I mean, Colonel Philip Morecambe was with him. He established his headquarters in the police station. At one stage, I had a platoon down near the Kuala Langat North Swamp, K-U-A-L-A-L-A-N-G-A-T, North Swamp, near a small village, the name of which I don't remember, which had an officer commanding a police district. And it was a chap called Peter Mingard, and I was in his pocket. So we, at all levels, yes, we operated very closely with the police.
And that was were they all English, if you see what I mean, policemen, or did you...
All the senior officers were English. The special branch were generally Chinese, for good reasons, obviously. Though their lives were fraught with danger one way or another. Of course, they were the people the communists would have dearly liked to eliminate. At the height of the emergency in the early days, remember, Palestine was vacated by us in May 48, and there had been a whole lot of warrant officers from the services had gone to Palestine as additional police lieutenants. They were all offered contracts in Malaya, and many of them came, and therefore there were a whole lot of English police lieutenants also.
The Palestine police, ex-Palestine.
Ex-Palestine police, yeah. Mostly, I mean, not all. There were some were recruited directly from the army and other services, directly from England as well. Because there were a hell of a lot there. Anything from inspectors downwards would have been generally Malay, with a very thin element of Indian. Remember, I said two-fifths Malay, two-fifths Chinese, one-fifth Indian, and etc. The police would generally be Malay,